From Settlement to Superpower, Episode 11, Cabeza de Vaca. Sinaloa, Mexico, sometime in the middle of March 1536. The day was hot and clear, the sun beating down from the cloudless skies. Here and there a lazy gust of wind would sweep up a small cloud of dust, which would then drift along the arid terrain, stretches of brown sand punctuated by small defiant patches of greenery. To the north and east towered the Sierra Madre Mountains, while the Sinaloa River slowly gurgled by. Amidst this desert landscape, four mounted figures picked their way towards the river. They were hot and tired, trapped in their Spanish armor, heated up under the baking Mexican sun. They had been on the move for quite some weeks now, and so far they have been less than successful in their mission. They were approximately 90 miles away from the nearest Spanish settlement, from which their operation was based. These men were slave hunters, and they had been searching for their human prey for quite a while. Unfortunately for them, however, previous Spanish depredations had already forced the native populations to scatter and hide, and these human traffickers were finding it extremely difficult to find and catch their elusive victims. They were tired, hungry, thirsty, and dispirited, and thoughts of home and the comforts it offered increasingly occupied their minds. Soon, they were ready to turn around and head back to their main camp, a mile and a half away. Suddenly, the lead horseman perked up. Ahead in the distance were 13 figures headed their way. And what remarkable figures they were! 11 of them seemed to be ordinary Indians, but leading them were two men, one a big brawny white man with a fiery red beard, and the second a tall and strong black man. Both of these men were clearly not Indians, and yet they were dressed, or to be more precise, undressed, exactly like the natives who accompanied them. They were as naked as the day upon which they were born. The horsemen just gaped, speechless, unable to even greet these strange men. The red-haired man hailed them in Spanish, declaring that he was a Christian and a subject of the King of Spain. The man then asked them the date and year, and upon hearing that it was March of 1536, turned to his black companion and murmured in slow wonderment. "Estebancito, my friend, can it be true? Has it really been 8 years?" To the dumbfounded horseman, the red-haired man said, "Take me to your commander. I am Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, and my companion and I, as well as two men some distance behind us, require shelter. 8 years ago, we departed for Florida with Pánfilo de Narváez, with a force 400 strong. Now, however," continued the man somberly, "my companions and I are all that remain." Hello everybody and welcome back. I'm Abraham Ash and this is From Settlement to Superpower. In this episode, we will cover the odyssey of woe and perseverance that is the story of Pánfilo de Narváez's expedition to Florida and its tragic end, with all but four of the main party succumbing to the trials and tribulations of the elements, starvation, and hostile Indians. Those four who survived managed to do so in the face of tremendous travail and difficulty, by force of their grit, determination, and belief in the hand of Providence. But before we introduce our characters for this episode, I would just like to make three corrections for last episode. I was in a bit of a hurry when I put up that episode, and as such I got a bit careless, so I apologize for the following three goofs. The first thing is not so much something I need to correct as much as it is something I need to apologize for, and that is the sloppy audio editing at about 23 minutes into the episode, where the words, "in any event in early 1520," play twice. That was just really careless on my part, and I really hope I never make such a blunder again. The The second thing I need to correct is at 26 minutes and 45 seconds when I said that the emissaries Cortes sent to Charles V were defeated by Spanish pirates. That was a slip of tongue on my part. The pirates were French. I was just so used to talking about the Spaniards that Spanish popped out of my mouth instead of French. And the third thing I need to correct is at around 33 minutes and 20 seconds when I was talking about the causal connection between Garay's exploration of the Gulf Coast and Ponce de Leon's second voyage to Florida. In the podcast, I said that such a connection seems unlikely before going on for 3 minutes about how such a connection clearly existed. As you may have figured out, when I said that such a connection was unlikely, I really meant that such a connection was likely. So yeah, that's a bit of a facepalm moment for me. But anyways, enough with this nattering, let's get on with the show and talk about Pánfilo de Narváez's attempt to conquer Florida. So, we last talked seriously about Narváez in episode 8, when he attempted to defeat Cortés in the name of Diego Velázquez. Of course, he was defeated by Cortés at Sempoala in 1520, where one of his eyes were knocked out by a lance. Following the battle, Cortés had him imprisoned, at first in Villarica de la Veracruz and following Cortés's final victory over the Aztecs in Mexico City. As we mentioned last episode, Narváez remained imprisoned until Governor Garay of Jamaica came to Mexico City in 1523 to negotiate his alleged rights to settle north of the Panuco River. Garay interceded on behalf of his old acquaintance to Cortés, and Cortés had Narváez, who was no longer a threat, released. In 1524, Narváez returned to Cuba, where his wife, Maria de Valenzuela, maintained a Penelope-like vigil, faithfully awaiting her husband's return. A better man would have settled down with his loving wife, comfortable with the ample savings he had accumulated. But Narváez was driven by greed, and he thirsted for the sort of wealth found by Cortés in Mexico. It rankled him that Cortés was being feted as a conquering hero, while he was no more than an afterthought, a failure who had been outmaneuvered by the cleverer Cortés. He wanted to etch his name onto the pantheon of heroes, and in his quest to do so, he would come to lose everything. Narváez headed over to Spain to request from Charles V the rights to conquer and colonize Florida, which had lain ignored ever since Ponce de Leon's death in 1521. On Christmas Day 1526, the king granted him the rights he requested, and authorized him to occupy the coast of Florida for the crown of Spain. Narváez immediately got to work, seeking out investors willing to fund and volunteers willing to man such a high-risk venture as a colonization attempt. By June of 1527, he had managed to gather a group of 600 sailors, soldiers, wives, and servants, whom he would bring with him to Florida. Of these men, there are a number whose names we should remember. Andrés Dorantes, a captain of infantry, Dorantes' black slave, Esteban, better known by the affectionate moniker Estebanico, and Captain Alonso del Castillo Maldonado of Salamanca. As Narváez's second-in-command treasurer and marshal, the king placed a trusted man of his by the name of Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca. As you likely know, Cabeza de Vaca is going to be the single most important character in this episode. He is the single primary source we have for what later befell the expedition. Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca was born in Jerez de la Frontera, a small city near Cádiz in 1490, to a family of the minor nobility. Now, when he was born, Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca was not born with the family name of Cabeza de Vaca. Cabeza de Vaca was his mother's name. His father's name, and by extension his own family name, was Francisco Núñez de Vera. Both the de Vera and the Cabeza de Vaca families were fairly distinguished families. Alvar's paternal grandfather, Pedro de Vera, conquered Gran Canary, the largest of the Canary Isles, for Castile back in 1480. Alvar's mother's family, the Cabezas de Vaca, owed their curious surname, which means cow's head in Spanish, to a distant ancestor of theirs who in 1212 had contributed to the major Christian victory over the Moors at Las Navas de Tolosa. The way in which he did so was by showing the Christian armies a secret mountain pass, by way of leaving a cow's skull out as a pointer, through which the Christians snuck and caught the Moors by surprise. The young Alvar was orphaned of both parents at an early age, although we don't know what their causes of death were, and he was raised by family, quite possibly by his father's father, the conqueror of Gran Canaria himself. Having grown up on martial themes, the fiery and red-headed Alvar dreamed of little but a military career, and in 1511, at the age of 21, Alvar joined the Spanish army, then fighting in the Italian peninsula as part of the War of the League of Cambrai. 1 year later, he was present at the disastrous defeat of the Spanish army at Ravenna, where almost two-thirds of the Spanish force were slain in the bloody rout which followed. Alvar, who had by now adopted as his surname his mother's name of Cabeza de Vaca instead of his father's name of de Vera, managed to survive the defeat, but the horror of it all seems to have dampened his enthusiasm for a military career. Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca shows up again in 1520, when he assists the Duke of Medina Sidonia in putting down the peasants of the Comunero uprising. All in all, his career up until 1527 was a rather undistinguished one. Cabeza de Vaca was a dependable man, of that you could be sure, but there was nothing to suggest any remarkable strength of character in the middle-aged man. Adversity has a remarkable way of bringing out a strength unimagined in some quite overlooked people, while exposing some of the most famous and respected men as weak and unreliable cowards. Cabeza de Vaca belonged to the former group. The ordeal he was about to undergo would strain him to his very limit, but he would emerge from it a colossus of willpower and endurance. While we're on the subject of Pánfilo de Narváez's recruitment for his voyage, there's one further detail regarding his recruitment efforts which, while not absolutely necessary for the retelling of his story, will undoubtedly be of interest to those of you who have listened to our previous episodes on the Spanish Caribbean. Narváez's expedition was different from those that preceded it by virtue of the fact that his recruitment was done in Spain, rather than on the islands of the Caribbean. Up until now, all of the expeditions we've documented were based out of the Caribbean islands. In other words, settlers of Cuba, Hispaniola, Jamaica, and Puerto Rico would realize that the mainland, soon to be known as the Spanish Main, offered far more opportunities in the way of wealth and power than their smaller and relatively depleted islands could possibly offer. And so they would risk all to strike out and explore new lands. So long as there was risk involved in traveling to the mainland, this wasn't very much of a problem, as there would always be those more cautious Spaniards unwilling to swallow the risks of conquering and building a colony from scratch. The perils of conquest would balance out the potential gains to be had in the event of success. Following Cortés' success in Mexico, however, a whole new world opened up to the Caribbean Spaniards. Mexico, with all of her riches and all of her Indians and all of her encomiendas, lay prostrate before the Spanish, and anyone could go to the rapidly expanding New Spain and with minimal risk obtain wealth which was, by now, more or less unattainable on the islands. This mass exodus of Spaniards for the mainland brought about a massive depopulation of the Spanish islands, a development which posed a serious problem to the crown. To counter this trend, the king passed, in November 1526, the Laws of Granada, which prohibited any Spaniard living on the islands to move to the other islands or the mainland without a specific permit. The penalty for non-compliance was draconian, death and the forfeiture of all the violators' property to the crown. It was as a result of this that Narváez was compelled to do all of his recruiting in Spain rather than in the Caribbean. In any event, this little tangent aside, Narváez was ready to sail in June of 1527. On the 17th, his expedition sailed for the New World from Sanlúcar de Barrameda, the nearest port to his hometown of Jerez de la Frontera. After an uneventful journey of 45 days, the expedition made for port in Santo Domingo, where they bought another ship, some horses, and stocked up on provisions. Even as the expedition stocked up on provisions, however, it was hemorrhaging men, as many of the men were frightened off by the stories they had heard about the suffering endured by the men of Ailón's failed colony of San Miguel de Guadalupe, who had straggled back to Hispaniola just a few months before. This fear, compounded by the opportunities that a relatively empty Hispaniola provided, induced many of the Spaniards to jump ship, and Narvaez to get out of Hispaniola as soon as possible. Narvaez's expedition lost a whopping 140 men to desertion while in Santo Domingo. Meanwhile, Cabeza de Vaca and another captain by the name of Pantoja were sent ahead to Trinidad, Cuba to load some more supplies. The expedition's bad luck continued here, and while Cabeza de Vaca and most of the men were ashore obtaining supplies, a raging hurricane swept into Cuba, leveling Trinidad and sinking the two ships, which went down with 20 horses and 60 hands. A few days later, on November 5th, Narvaez and his four ships came limping into Trinidad, his ships as well severely damaged by the storm. Narvaez wished to press on, but his frightened men prevailed on him to wait out the worst of the winter in Cuba, where he remained until late February. By late February, everybody was ready to get a move on things. Narvaez loaded up his force, by now diminished from 600 to 400 people, and instructed his pilot to bring them to Havana, where they would resupply and buy another ship before moving on to Florida. The problem was that Narvaez's pilot, Diego de Miruelo, who may have been the same incompetent pilot who made an illegal voyage to Ponce de Leon's Florida in 1517, but forgot to record navigational data about the coast of Florida, well, this guy was a complete hack. He claimed to be intimately familiar with every detail of the coast of Florida, but pretty soon he showed that to be untrue when he grounded the ships on shoals, where they remained stuck for 15 days. Finally, they got free, only to encounter severe storms while rounding the western tip of Cuba. When they were less than 50 miles away from Havana, they were driven due north by a strong wind, making landfall on the west coast of Florida in early May 1528, taking possession of it for the crown of Spain on the following day. A couple of days later, the Spanish began to explore the area in which they now found themselves. On the first day, they found an abandoned Indian village where they discovered nothing of note besides for a small gold rattle which inflated their hopes well beyond proportion to its actual significance. The next day, they came across an Indian village called Hirihigua, where they found, much to their surprise, that the Indians were using Castilian merchant crates as coffins. When the Indians were challenged regarding the provenance of the crates, they said that they were retrieved from a nearby Spanish shipwreck some time ago. Narvaez, however, did not believe them, and his vindictive reaction showed how once again he was nothing compared to his rival Cortes. Cortes would have pretended to accept the chief's explanation, yet remained on his guard to prevent any sort of treachery, all the while looking for an opportunity to cow the Indians by a show of force without actually making them into his enemies. Narvaez, however, was too cruel and too stupid for such calculations, so instead he seized the village chief, Uquita, and sliced off his nose, before throwing his mother to the dogs to be torn apart and eaten alive. Cabeza de Vaca doesn't record this detail, saying only that the Spaniards burnt the crates, but we know what happened anyways, as I'm going to explain later on in the episode. The pilot, Miruelo, had said that he knew of a great sheltered bay to the north, and Pánfilo de Narváez told him to take a brig and find the great bay. In the event he was unsuccessful, he should go back to Havana and return to Florida with supplies. After Miruelo's departure, the local Indians, who wanted nothing more than to get the Spaniards out of their hair, told them that if they went further north to a place called Apalache, they would find more gold. So north Narvaez and the expedition went. However, as he set out on this northward march, Narvaez committed the reckless blunder which would bring him and virtually all of his men to a horrible end. Since Miruelo hadn't returned with news of this great harbor, Narvaez decided to send all of his ships out to go and find this bay together. They were instructed to find the bay and then lay at anchor there until Narvaez and his men, traveling overland from the coast, would rendezvous with them. Now, I don't think I need to tell you how stupid of an idea this was. When you're leading a small group of men in a strange land with hostile natives all around, you don't just separate from your ships without a clear plan to get back together. Cabeza de Vaca protested at this blunder, predicting that if the ships and men would separate, the two groups would never lay eyes on one another ever again. Narváez was furious at this challenge to his decision, and he accused Cabeza de Vaca of cowardice, telling him in effect, "Okay, if you're too afraid to stay on land while the ships go ahead, then I'll let you command the ships." Cabeza de Vaca, prickly Spaniard that he was, of course got offended by the accusation of cowardice, and insisted that no, he would stay with the land party because he can never abandon them to the fate he knew awaited them. It was a matter of honor. He'd rather die than have it said that he abandoned his comrades to die out of cowardice. Instead, a minor lieutenant was given command of the ships, and the ships sailed away. As Cabeza de Vaca predicted, Narváez and the men would never see the ships again. Nor was Cabeza de Vaca the only one to make such a grim prophecy. Upon the departure of the ship, some of the men in the expedition's wives were similarly distraught, urging their husbands not to go along with this fool's errand and to return home. When Narváez scorned the women's fear, saying that while without a doubt some of the men would die, the rest of them would become fabulously wealthy, one of the women turned towards her fellows and said that they may as well begin searching for new husbands from now. Events would show her and Cabeza de Vaca to be correct. You see, the big bay Miruela was talking about was Tampa Bay. The problem here was that Narváez and Miruela both thought that the bay was to the north of Narváez's location, and so that was the direction in which Narváez and his expedition were headed. The problem, however, was that Tampa Bay was to the south of Narváez's position. In other words, Narváez was heading away from his rendezvous point. Pánfilo de Narváez and his remaining force of some 300 men continued marching north on their own towards the land of Apalache in the Florida Panhandle. At the Withlacoochee River, some 2 weeks and 70 miles north of Tampa, the Spanish fought their first battle against a force of 200 natives who attempted to block the river crossing. The Spanish were by now starting to get nervous, so Narváez sent a search party to find the bay on the coast. As you may have predicted, the scouts came back empty-handed and crestfallen, reporting that there was no bay nor any sail on the horizon. Only many years later would the few survivors find out what had happened with the two groups of ships. The main fleet, the one which Cabeza de Vaca was supposed to command, had sailed to the north and attempted to find the bay everyone was talking about, only to find upon their return that the bay was in fact to their south. Upon realizing this, the fleet embarked on a year-long search, ranging the west coast of Florida in an attempt to reconnect with Narváez and his men. After a year of fruitless searching, they gave up the attempt and headed to New Spain. Meanwhile, Miruelo, who had been sent out before the general fleet, headed back to Cuba as he had been instructed. He restocked and then headed back to Tampa Bay, where the other fleet had been before. However, by that time, the other fleet had already departed from Tampa Bay and was ranging the coast, searching for Narváez and his party. A boarding party of four from Miruelo's ship landed ashore to see if they could find any sign of Narváez and his men, whereupon they were immediately surrounded by a crowd of angry natives. To the Spaniards' misfortune, these Indians were from Hirahigua, the village of Uquita, the chief whose nose had been cut off by Narváez and whose mother had been fed to the dogs. Well, Uquita was steaming mad, and he was out for revenge. He had the four Spaniards who had surrendered without a fight brought to the village, and I will let Garcilaso de la Vega, a chronicler of the later De Soto expedition, which will be the subject of our next episode, take over the story of the four men from here. The excerpt is a little lengthy, but the story of Juan Ortiz's survival is no less extraordinary than that of Cabeza de Vaca. And just a note on the nomenclature. Garcilaso de la Vega calls Uquita throughout his account Hirahigua on account of the name of his village. This is not infrequent in European accounts. Very often they follow the European conventions in styling Indian chiefs after the name of their tribe or village, much as the Duke of Norfolk would simply be styled Norfolk or the Duke of Essex would be called just Essex. We're going to see, for example, when we come to Jamestown that the chief of the Powhatan Confederacy, whose real name was Wahunsakok, will be called Powhatan by virtually every European writer both at that time and afterwards. We find the same thing here where Uquita is styled as Hirahigua, a device which, just as in the case of Powhatan in Virginia, has led many people since to believe that this was in fact his actual name. Anyways, on to Garcilaso de la Vega's account, and I quote, "The chief Hirihigua now ordered that the four Spaniards be guarded most cautiously, so that with their death the Indians might solemnize a great feast which, according to the rites of paganism, they expected to celebrate in a few days. Then, with the arrival of that festival, the chief commanded that the captives be taken naked to the plaza and there be made to run in turn from one side to the other while the Indians shot arrows at them as if they were wild beasts. But to further delay the death and increase the agony of the victims, while at the same time to prolong and enliven their own festivity and enjoyment, they were only to discharge a few arrows at a time. Three of the Spaniards were tortured in this manner, and Hirohigo derived a great amount of pleasure and delight as he watched them flee in all directions, searching for a refuge they found only in death. But when the Indians wanted to bring out the fourth, a native of Seville named Juan Ortiz, who was scarcely 18 years of age, the chief's wife came out with her three daughters and, standing before her husband, begged that he be content with the deaths of the three captives and pardon the fourth, since he and his companions had not come to the land with Pánfilo de Narváez and were therefore guiltless of the wickedness perpetrated by their predecessors. This particular boy, she said, was deserving of forgiveness because of his tender age, which gave proof of his innocence and pled for compassion, and since he had committed no crime, it was therefore enough that he remain with them as a slave and not be destroyed so cruelly. In an effort to make his wife and daughters happy, the chief for the time being spared the life of Juan Ortiz, but afterwards he tortured him so grievously and bitterly that the boy frequently was moved to envy his three dead companions. The ceaseless labor of carrying firewood and water was so strenuous, the eating and sleeping were so infrequent, and the daily slaps, blows, and lashes, as well as the other torments given him on feast days, were so cruel that he many times would have sought relief in suicide had he not been a Christian. For in addition to daily tortures, Hirihigua, on numerous occasions of celebration, just as a diversion, ordered the boy to run continuously the entire day in the long plaza where his comrades had been slain. He himself went out to watch, taking his noblemen, who carried bows and arrows with them, with which to kill the captive at any time should he pause. Thus, Juan Ortiz began at sunrise and continued from one side of the plaza to the other until sunset, these being the time limits allotted by the Indians for him to run. And even when Hirohigo went away to eat, he left his cavaliers to watch the youth so that they might slay him in the event he should stop. Then, when the day was over, the sad youth lay extended on the ground, more dead than alive, as one can imagine. But on such occasions as these, he received the compassion of the chieftain's wife and daughters, who took him and clothed him and did other things which helped sustain his life, although it would have been better had they deprived him of it and thereby freed him from his many tasks. Hirohigo now realized that such numerous and continuous torments were not sufficient to destroy Juan Ortiz, and his hatred for him increased by the hour. So to finish with the youth, he gave the order on a certain feast day to kindle a great fire in the center of the plaza, and when he saw many live coals made, he ordered that they be spread out and over them be placed a grill-like wooden structure which stood a yard above the ground, and upon which they should put his captive to roast him alive. Thus it was done, and here the poor Spaniard, after being tied to the grill, lay stretched on one side for a long time. But at the shrieks of the miserable youth, the chief's wife and daughters rushed up and, pleading with their lord, even scolding him for his cruelty, removed the boy from the fire, not, however, before he was half-baked, and blisters that looked like halves of oranges had formed on one of his sides. Some of these blisters burst, and much blood ran from them, so that they were painful to behold. Hirohigo overlooked what his wife and daughters were doing because they were women whom he loved dearly, and possibly because he also wanted somebody on whom he might later vent his wrath and exercise his vengeance. And although Juan Ortiz presented the chief with less of an opportunity for vengeance than he desired, still he was amused with that little. Thus, he often expressed regret that he had destroyed the other three Spaniards so precipitously. The women, on the other hand, had time and again repented of having saved Juan Ortiz from death on that first occasion, seeing how long and cruel his daily torments had been. But being moved to great compassion upon seeing him in his current state, they took him to their lodgings and treated him with the juices of herbs. Hence, after many days, Juan Ortiz recovered, although the burns from the fire left great scars. End quote. There's plenty more there in Garcilaso de la Vega, but I'm not going to belabor the point. Hirohigo continued to torment the boy and give him extremely dangerous jobs, but the boy managed to hold on. Finally, however, Ukita got fed up with Ortiz and informed his family that the next day he would sacrifice Ortiz for once and for all and be done with it. This time, he was not to be dissuaded and not to be shaken from his resolve. Ortiz would die, and that was that. Realizing that this time they would not be able to save Ortiz, the women decided to help him escape. The eldest daughter, a girl named Ulele, came to him in the night and warned him of what lay in store for him on the following morning if he did not escape at once. She told him to flee to a nearby village, that of Mocoso, where the young chief was in love with her. He was to tell Mocoso that Ulele from Hirohigua had sent him, and that she requested that he safeguard him for her sake. Ortiz followed her advice and fled from Hirohigua that night after a captivity of a year and a half. When he arrived, Mocoso greeted him warmly and pledged to protect him no matter what. Mocoso kept his word, and even when Ukita sent angry messages demanding that his slave be returned, Mocoso declined. He refused to abjure his pledge of protection, which he had extended to the poor Spanish youth. Mocoso even refused after it had become clear that if he did not consent to Ukita's demands, he would never be allowed to marry his daughter Ulele, whom, as we have said, he loved dearly. Juan Ortiz would live in Mocoso for another 10 peaceful years before he would finally be rescued, the details of which we will recount next episode. So that was what happened with the fleet. So now, just to reground ourselves in our main storyline, we're talking about how Narvaez, on his march north to Appalachia, lost his ships, who had spent the fruitless year scouring the coast for him before finally giving the search up. The stranded Narvaez, meanwhile, continued pressing up the coast. Over a month later, he and his men finally reached Appalachia, where they expected to find both food and gold. Upon their arrival at the village, Cabeza de Vaca led a force of Spaniards who took over the village with ease, finding only the women and children present, whom they took captive as they plundered the stores of corn. An hour or two later, the Indian men returned, demanding that their women and children be freed. To this, the Spaniards agreed, but instead of subsequently trying to befriend the Appalachinos, the Spanish stupidly infuriated them by taking their chief hostage. The Appalachinos attacked the Spanish, setting fire to the house in which they were staying and then shooting arrows at the fleeing Spaniards. Although only one of Narvaez's party was killed, an Aztec prince whom they had taken along, the Spanish were forced to retire from the town. They stayed on the outskirts of the town for 25 days, scouting out the surrounding areas and questioning all of the Indians who they came across. They were told that the area around was sparsely populated and poor, but 9 days' journey to the south lay the village of Aute, which had ample stores of corn and pumpkins. The Spanish decided to travel to Aute, where they would hopefully get more supplies. The problem, however, was that this advice was probably a trap. As they would find, after a journey of much difficulty, Aute lay abandoned, and the way there was all marsh and quicksand. All along the route, the Spanish struggled through the difficult terrain while the vindictive Appalachinos waged a guerrilla war against them. The Appalachinos were probably the finest bowmen in the entire New World. They carried bows that were 6 feet long and so taut that no Spaniards were even able to bend them, and which shot arrows with such force that Cabeza de Vaca relates that they saw on several occasions Appalachino arrows piercing through an entire oak trunk. The Appalachinos would hide behind trees, and every so often, particularly when the Spanish were struggling through difficult terrain, they would dart out and let loose their arrows. The Appalachino warriors were also very swift and never presented a stationary target, so that the Spanish were unable to bring their arquebuses and crossbows to bear against them. At Aute, as we said, the Spanish found the settlement deserted and in ashes. Malaria began to set in as well, and the Spaniards were soon hemmed in on all sides by swamps, rivers, and marshes. Desperate to get out, Narvaez sent another expedition to search for the coast, but they soon returned and said that there was no open sea to their west, only a bewildering maze of bays and marshes. Narvaez and his party were running out of options. Their best bet, everybody agreed, was to build their own ships and head out to sea. The problem, however, was that they had only one carpenter with them, no iron other than their weapons and armor, no forge, no hemp for rope, no oakum for caulking, and no cloth for sails. And worst of all, they had no food to sustain them in their labors. How on earth were they supposed to make a ship, let alone enough ships to get them all out? It is said that necessity is the mother of all invention, and nowhere does that dictum apply more than over here. Displaying extraordinary innovation, the desperate men got to work creating ramshackle ships to get them home. They made a forge from wood and bellows from leather, while the men all gave up their stirrups, spurs, and crossbow metal to create tools and nails. They figured out how to turn palmetto fibers into oakum and pine sap into pitch. For food, the Spaniards agreed to kill one horse every 3 days, with the hairs from the mane and tail being used to make rope. The Spaniards took all the extra clothing they had to patch together and create makeshift sails. In general, they met their shipbuilding needs through ingenuity and hard sacrifice. All the while, the Spaniards were suffering losses from the Apalachinos, who remained in the vicinity of Aute. On one occasion, 10 Spaniards were killed by an arrow barrage right in front of the entire camp. By September 20th, the work was done. Many Spaniards had died, and all but one of the horses had been killed for food, but they had at last done it. 5 ships had been made, rickety and barely seaworthy, but yet there they were. Their gunwales were only 9 inches above the waterline, and they were being manned by men who knew nothing of seamanship or navigation. The plan was to just launch out and hope that they reached Spanish territory before they got killed. They split up the 250 men who remained into the 5 boats, 50 into each of the vessels. Narvaez commanded the first of the vessels. The 2 captains, Dorantes and Castillo, took command of the second vessel. The third was commanded by Fray Juan Suarez, a priest and the commissary of the expedition. The fourth by Cabeza de Vaca. And the fifth by another 2 captains whose names I won't bother you with. Just remember, the expedition split into 5 boats, whose fates we are now going to recount. For the first week, the ships struggled to find their way through the marshes and to the open sea. On September 27, 1528, they succeeded in doing so. They sailed along the coast, buffeted by storms, occasionally taking shelter in coves along the shore. Several men died along the way from drinking salt water. Eventually, the Spanish reached Pensacola Bay on the Florida Panhandle, where they were able to resupply with fresh water, which, as we've said, had run out. Shortly thereafter, however, the natives turned hostile and the Spanish were forced to flee again, suffering 3 men killed and over 50 wounded. As the Spanish sailed along past Mobile, Alabama, and into Mississippi, their ships were blown apart by strong winds. For several days, the Spanish ships hove in and out of sight of one another, now joining one another, now getting broken apart, and then joining with another boat. At one point, Cabeza de Vaca's ship came within shouting distance of Narvaez, and de Vaca called out to Narvaez, asking him what his orders were. Narvaez shouted out, struggling to be heard over the distance, "The time for orders is past, senor. Every man must do as he sees fit to save his own life. And that is what I intend to do myself." The selfishness and incompetence of Narvaez are further accentuated here. His life had more than once been spared through the self-sacrifice of his men, yet he now thought more of saving himself with the aid of his hardy crew than of lending a hand to his weakened companions. In any event, Divaka would never see Narvaez again, although he would learn of his fate from others who were with him. Eventually, Divaka and his weakened, starved, and thirsty crew were all alone, hovering between life and death. They had been living on a daily ration of a handful of raw corn. Alonso de Solis, Divaca's second in command, lay still, so much so that Divaca, who was steering the craft, thought him to be dead. Suddenly, the supine crew were jolted into consciousness by a thump. Their ship had washed ashore onto an island, probably Galveston Island off the coast of Texas. Divaca and his crew of 40, barely able to stand, signaled to the natives who surrounded them that they came as friends. Upon seeing that they were no threat, the natives supplied them with food and drink. The Spanish then attempted to depart the island, loading up their one remaining ship and launching out to sea. However, a few hundred feet out into sea, a giant wave came and overturned the rickety craft. Solis and several others were drowned, while the rest were washed ashore, naked, emaciated, and shivering in the cold November air. The Indians, seeing the misery of the wretched castaways, brought them to the village, fed them, and lit fires to warm them. The Spaniards, thinking that they were to be sacrificed, were despondent, but as it turned out, the Indians bore them no ill will and had no intention of doing them injury, at least not for now. The next day, the 35 men of Divaca's crew were joined by the crew of another ship, the one commanded by Dorantes and Castillo. They too had crashed on the shore and wanted to sail away, but their ship was too damaged to sail any further. Four of the Spaniards went westward on foot to search for Panuco, which they thought was not too far from where they were. Of course, it was 700 miles away, across lands populated by fierce Indian tribes, but these Spaniards didn't realize that. Deep winter set in on the 80 or so Spaniards left on Galveston, which they aptly named the Isla de Malhado, or the Isle of Misfortune. As the weather got colder, the food got scarcer, and soon the Spanish were forced to separate and spread out across the island to forage for food. The problem was that there was little food to be had. Over that winter, the Spaniards suffered horribly. Cabeza de Vaca tells us that there were a number of times when he himself went for 3 full days without eating anything. Many of the Spanish resorted to cannibalizing their own dead in order to survive, much to the horror and disgust of the local Indians. In addition to the starvation, a disease broke out among the Indians, killing many of them. Initially, the Indians blamed the Spaniards and were making ready to kill them until one of the Indians dissuaded his brethren, saying that if this death was in the hands of the Spaniards, then they would not be inflicting it on themselves as well. The fact that the Spaniards were dying as well was indicative that they had no such power. The Indians were convinced and left the Spaniards alone. During this time, Cabeza de Vaca and several others began their careers as medicine men, praying over the sick Indians that they be spared. For whatever reason, and according to de Vaca, they had a high success rate, which led to the Indians revering him as a medicine man. But whatever his skills as a medicine man, his compatriots still continued to die of starvation and exposure. By the spring of 1529, only 15 Spaniards were left alive at Galveston. In the springtime, the Spaniards, who were not too sick to travel, 12 in all, not including Cabeza de Vaca, decided to leave Galveston in order to continue heading towards Panuco. The natives of Galveston were eager to see the Spaniards off, and they brought them in their canoes to the mainland. The Spanish stumbled down the coast, picking up one unnamed Christian along the way and losing 4 others to starvation and the elements. Around 60 miles south of Galveston, the Spaniards met one of the 4 men who had departed Galveston before the winter to search for Panuco. This man was the last survivor of that group. He was being held captive by a local tribe, but he had news of the 2 other ships. The ones commanded by Narvaez and Fray Suarez. Suarez's boat had been wrecked along the Texan coast, and while his men tramped down the shore, they were spotted by Narvaez and his crew. Narvaez sent some men ashore, and the 2 parties continued moving south together. One night, Narvaez, who was extremely weak and in ill temper, got into a massive fight with one of the officers of the expedition and, in a fit of pique, decided that he was going to spend the night aboard the ship rather than ashore with the men. That night, however, a strong northerly came and the ship's moorings detached, and by the morning Narvaez and the ship were gone, never to be seen again. Over the course of the winter of 1528-1529, the rest of the two ships' crews died of starvation, Indian attacks, and occasionally murder at the hands of their fellow Spaniards. The dead were all cannibalized, and by the end of the winter, only one man remained of the two ship crews, Hernando de Esquivel. The Spaniard from Galveston had heard Esquivel's whole story and urged him to go on with him to Panuco, but Esquivel, who was possibly quite mad by this point, refused, saying Panuco was in the other direction. Esquivel himself didn't last much longer. Just a few weeks later, he was killed when an Indian woman had a dream that he murdered her child. And by the way, don't think that the Europeans were more advanced than that sort of superstition. A century and a half later, you would have executions in the Salem witch trials on the basis of similar evidence. In any event, the remaining Spaniards were soon split and enslaved by the various Indian tribes, and slowly but surely, all but three died off or were killed. Those three were Castillo, Dorantes, and Dorantes' slave, Estebanico. Meanwhile, back on Galveston Island, Cabeza de Vaca and one other Spaniard still remained. They, along with the third Spaniard, had been too sick to travel in 1529 with the rest of the Spaniards when they left Galveston Island to head south. The third Spaniard had died of his illness, but Cabeza de Vaca and his companion, a man by the name of Oviedo, had survived. For a year or so, they were enslaved by the local Indians until Cabeza de Vaca decided to escape and seek the lands of the Christians to the south. His companion, however, was too afraid to join him, so Cabeza de Vaca went alone. Upon reaching the mainland, he encountered another tribe of Indians who took him in but gave him much greater latitude than his former masters, allowing him to travel around the entire region to trade. After a few years of this, Cabeza de Vaca left and headed southwards to meet his friends whom he knew had headed in that direction. On his way down south, he encountered a tribe of Indians who gleefully informed him that only three of his companions were left alive, and that they were daily beaten and abused, and the hostile natives indicated to Cabeza de Vaca that soon they would do the same to him. But bluster aside, the natives brought him to the Guadalupe River, where the tribes who held the other three Spaniards would arrive soon to gather pecans. In the autumn of 1532, Cabeza de Vaca was reunited with Dorantes. Cabeza de Vaca gives us his account of the meeting between the pair of them and the plan which they hatched for their escape. "When I arrived near their abode, Andres Dorantes came out to see who it could be, for the Indians had told him that a Christian was coming. His astonishment was great when he saw me, as they had for many a day considered me dead, and the natives had said that I was. We gave many thanks at seeing ourselves together, and this was a day to us of the greatest pleasure we had enjoyed in life. Having come to where Castillo was, they inquired of me where I was going. I told them my purpose was to reach the land of Christians, I being then in search and pursuit of it. Andres Dorantes said that for a long time he had entreated Castillo and Estebanico to go forward, but that they dared not venture because they knew not how to swim, and greatly dreaded the rivers and bays they should have to cross, there being many in that country. Thus the Almighty had been pleased to preserve me through many trials and diseases, conducting me in the end to the fellowship of those who had abandoned me, so that I might lead them over the bays and rivers that obstructed our progress. They advised me on no account to let the natives know or have a suspicion of my desire to go on, else they would destroy me, and that for success, it would be necessary for me to remain quiet until the end of 6 months, when comes the season in which these Indians go to another part of the country to eat prickly pears. People would arrive from parts farther on, bringing bows to barter and for exchange, with whom, after making our escape, we should be able to go on their return. Having consented to this course of action, I remained. End quote. For the next 6 months, Cabeza de Vaca was enslaved by an Indian family. But he bided his time patiently, waiting for the prickly pear season, when all the tribes would gather and when he could escape with his comrades. Their plan, however, came to naught when the Indians quarreled at the next pear season and terminated the gathering early. The Spaniards had to wait yet another year until the pear season of 1534. They met again, but once again their plans were confounded when the Indians, suspecting that the Christians were planning something, beat them and forcibly separated them after just one day. Cabeza de Vaca called out to his friends to meet him at the next full moon, and if they did not make it, he swore that he would escape himself. During this time, Cabeza de Vaca also found out what had befallen the fifth and final ship which had departed Florida with them. That ship had gone the farthest of all, but it was apparently not far enough, and when they finally were wrecked on the Texan coast, they were too weak to resist as the natives slew them and took everything they had. This meant that Cabeza de Vaca and his three friends were the only ones left of the expedition. They would make it back, he promised himself, no matter what, and he would publicize what had happened. At the next full moon in September of 1534, Cabeza de Vaca met his three comrades, and together they made good on their escape. They fled towards the south in the direction of rising smoke they had seen at the horizon, and arrived by sunset at an Indian tribe, who welcomed them with open arms. They continued on south with the Indians, with whom they lived for about a year. It was during this time that Cabeza de Vaca and his companions gained an almost religious, mythological significance among the natives. You see, they had a reputation as medicine men. The natives would bring sick people to them, they would pray over them, and they would get better. This made the natives see them as holy medicine men or miracle workers, and wherever they went, they were followed by a team of natives who were just giving them food, and if they passed a village that didn't give them food, the natives plundered it for food, and things kind of got surreal here, where they were walking all day long, day in, day out, with this crowd of Indians following them and revering them as these basically religious leaders. Finally, in August of 1535, Cabeza de Vaca and his companions began their journey to the land of the Christians in earnest. They had traveled some distance down the coast of Texas and Mexico, but now they decided to head inland, as the natives on the shore were considered much more fierce and warlike and unfriendly. As the experience of the following two centuries of shipwrecked Spaniards would show, that was the correct decision to make. In any event, August of 1535, they started heading out westward. They trekked day in and day out, naked, across the hot desert, surrounded by these crowds of followers. They continued walking for a year, until they had finally reached the other side of Mexico. And although they may not have known it, they were very close to the Pacific Ocean. It was here in Sinaloa that they were picked up by the slave traders in March 1536. The unscrupulous slave traders actually wanted to take the massive Indian entourage accompanying Cabeza de Vaca and his companions as slaves, but Cabeza de Vaca fought tooth and nail against it. Finally, having the Native Americans convert to Christianity as a shield to protect them from the depredations of the slave raiders. And that was that. Shortly thereafter, Cabeza de Vaca and his companions returned to Mexico City, where they were welcomed almost like heroes. Everyone was shocked, astounded, everyone wanted to hear their story. They made a tremendous impression on the people of Mexico. After staying in Mexico City for a few months, Cabeza de Vaca headed back to Spain, where he wrote and published an account of the entire journey, which is the primary source material which we have. The other two free men, Castillo and Dorantes, lived out the rest of their lives in obscurity in the New World. and Durante's slave, Estebanico, was shortly thereafter sold to the Viceroy of New Spain. And we'll meet him again a long time in the future when we discuss the Coronado expedition. All in all, the expedition of Pánfilo de Narváez did very little in actually furthering the settlement of the United States. As a matter of fact, it did absolutely nothing in furthering anything. But it is one of those great stories which has come down to us through the exploits of the Europeans in what is now the United States of America. Next episode, we're going to discuss a similar story. Again, an expedition which accomplished very little in terms of concrete results, but which nonetheless is a great story and was actually a fairly seminal moment in terms of European exploration of the United States of America. That expedition will be the expedition of Hernando de Soto. I can't wait to tell you about it next time.